Today, we've got a fresh new episode of Streaming Audio, a podcast about Kafka, Confluent, and the cloud. Welcome back to another edition of Streaming Audio. I am your host, Tim Berglund, and in the studio with me today, the virtual studio, of course, I have my friend and coworker, Bill Bijek. Bill, welcome.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Awesome to have you here. Now, you just finished a book, Kafka Streams in Action.
Yes.
And I want to talk about that book, talk about Kafka Streams a little bit. What was it? I also am an author of a technical book. Tell me, what was it like doing this?
Pain and joy all at the same time. Very time consuming, the most time consuming thing I had taken on. I knew it was going to
even know.
Yeah. I knew it was going to be time consuming, but it's one of those things you don't know till you get into it.
And you're just like, how can it take so long to write 200 words? What is wrong with my brain? You
know? Well, that, and you write a chapter and you feel reasonably comfortable with it. And then you go through the editing process and then you go back and you never realize how unclear you're being. You never realize the assumptions you're making because the editor comes back and says, what do you mean by this? What do you mean by that? You know, I can infer, but you need to be explicit here. And just that back and forth, it just takes writing the rough draft of a chapter is time intensive, but then just the back and forth, that really just kind of, that's where the big bulk of the time came for me.
And when there's code involved, you know, obviously, you know,
yeah. The
underlying API sort of kind of well, but you still have to write code for a book like this for it to be useful. And that's pretty time consuming too.
Yeah, exactly.
Tell us about the API itself. I mean, just kind of walk us through, if you want to go through like the outline or what are, in your view, if there's a listener who's new to the Streams API, first of all, how do you begin explaining it? What is it? And then what are some high points? Just kind of talk to us.
Well, I guess we'll make the assumption that the person is familiar with Kafka itself.
There you go.
Because to understand Kafka Streams, you have to have a decent understanding of Kafka itself. It's a library. Kafka Streams is a library that runs on top of Kafka, not literally within Kafka itself. But if I take a step back and say you're familiar with Kafka, you have a producer and you write data into Kafka. You've got data that you want to get picked. You're picking up data. You're writing in like event-driven data. You're writing those events into Kafka, into a topic. Then to make use of that data, you have a consumer that's going to be reading from that topic and it's going to be pulling them off and you do things with those events. You might be writing them back to you might be processing that data, running it back to yet another topic. You might be transforming it and writing that data into Elasticsearch so people can search on these events, anything like that.
And that consumer API, I guess to set you up, doesn't do a lot for you, right? It's like, here's your messages, here, go do them, do something, right?
Exactly. I mean, it does, there is one cool thing about the consumer, and this is more a thing of Kafka, is you've got the notion of a consumer group. So let's just say you've got a lot of records coming in and you want to parallelize and you want to have multiple threads running and you have these consumers running in multiple threads. They're part of a consumer group. So if for some reason, one of those consumer threads were to die or something were to happen, you have what's called the rebalance protocol. The group manager would recognize one of those consumers, hey, they dropped off. Contact the other two. Okay, I'm skipping over a detail here about partitions, but they would assign the work or the partitions that were assigned to the consumer that died. Those now get assigned to the ones that are still working.
Yeah, so which sounds great, right? Yeah, I mean, that's cool that happens automatically.
Yeah, so you get that. But no, you're right. You don't. You're doing all the work yourself. You set up the consumer. It hands you records, and basically it's like, here you go, here are your records, and you're kind of on your own there. And then if you want to...
And that rebalance is awesome if you don't have any state in memory, right? If you don't know anything about the last message you got, and and you know, you get a partition taken from you and put to another consumer in the consumer group, that's fine. You have no state. But if you're stateless, life is kind of bad for you if you're consumer only, right?
Yeah, exactly.
You're stateful, if you're stateful.
Stateful. So what Kafka Streams does is it's got underneath it, it's an abstraction layer. It's got consumer, it's got, depending on how many threads you have, but there's a consumer and a producer. But you just point, when you configure your Kafka Streams application, I'm speaking at a high level here, one of the configs you give it is the brokers or the Bootstrap broker list that it connects to. And then you create a stream object, a KStream object off of a source. You give it the, you say streambuilder.source, you give it a topic or a multiple topics or a regular expression to match patterns of topics. And then you get back a KStream object. And then from there, you can do all sorts of operations, you know, map, filter. You can do stateful operations where you can keep state, keep context of messages that are coming in.
Like grouping, for example, if you want to group by the key or something.
Exactly. And you can even rekey. It makes it easier to rekey because let's just say you're coming in and your messages aren't keyed. You're getting customer data, but it's coming raw off of a feed somewhere that just has the customer purchase data in one object. And then you need to extract out the customer ID and you want to put that as the key. It makes it easy to rekey that object, rekey that record. And then, like you said, you can group by key and then you can do counts, aggregations, reducing on that.
And it looks, it's a podcast. We don't look at code because it's audio, but it looks like, you know, if you've used any like collections API in the last 5 or 10 years, or you know, any functional language that has emerged in the last 10 years, it's got all the usual suspects. Like you named them off. There's a map and there's a reduce and there's filter, and it feels like functional programming. It's this kind of functional paradigm where you're no longer saying the API gives you a key value pair and you can imperatively do steps with it, but you're saying, hey, this is a stream, and go apply this function in this way to all these messages. It's kind of the deal, right?
Exactly. And that's one of the key things that I like about it is you get out of the imperative to more declarative. You're not saying how to do it. You're saying do this for, you know, for each record that gets streamed through. And what's really nice is the operators, you have, like, say, KStream map, KStream flat map. They expect to take single argument methods, SAM methods. So it's in this Java 8 world, it makes it really easy to write these concise Lambda functions,
right,
that you pass in. So, you know, if anyone remembers the pre-Java 8, you know, you try and write an anonymous class or an implementation of an interface, the boilerplate, would just kind of explode. And not all useful. You know, it's a lot of curly braces. And
I mean, I straightforwardly simply didn't do it. I would like go write the code in Groovy or something. I just wouldn't do it in Java because it was that bad.
Yeah, no. And that's what I really like. So you talk about functional flavor. You create these functions or first class objects, and then you can just, you know, you just pass those in. And so you're kind of taken out of, you know, you have your event stream and you know what you want to do to each event, and that's what you start building up. So you can build up a simple topology, or you can build up a pretty complex topology, and it doesn't require a lot of code. There's something we can get into later, KSQL, where you don't even write any code, but that's, I'm getting ahead of myself here. And that's what I really like about it, is it kind of lets you focus more on your business application logic.
You're not worried
about the low level details.
Right. Also with that functional paradigm where you're basically just passing in lambdas, you know, in a lot of the, so like in my role, sometimes I'll demo this in front of audiences, right? I'll live code. I've got a little Streams app that I live code in front of people on it. Yeah. It, by the way, if you've ever seen it, it kind of makes some shortcuts. You'll probably look at it. You'd be like, ooh, that's going to create inconsistent results sometimes, but it demos well. So
yeah,
it's not wrong. It's just simplified. Anyway, when you're doing that, like the simple kind of stuff that I'll demo, they'll always be just inline lambdas. Of course, they don't have to be. You know, you can have proper methods in classes of their own where you're passing those in. And the nice thing is that this all deals with, or at least can deal with, native types. If you've got this in cooperation with the Confluent Schema Registry, you can have like, oh, here is my sensor IoT POJO or whatever it is, this thing that encapsulates all the stuff I get from my Kafka message. And those are the input and output. That's the return type and the input parameters to these lambdas are all those native types. So you can just write tests that are kind of trivial. There's no stubbing to do. It's just, here's this thing and here's my types and I move them in and out.
Yeah. And that's actually another thing I'm glad you mentioned, testing, that I really liked is depending what you're doing. You know, if you're calling filter, you pass in a predicate. Okay, you should test a predicate. You know, you could have a proper predicate, you know, class. But if you have Kafka Streams has a notion of passing in processors or transformers, and those are passed in by suppliers. And the nice thing is with that, you can use the lambda notation and then have it invoke, create a new processor each time. But that processor, like you said, can be a standalone class. And unit testing is easy because you just test the functionality within your processor. You don't have to worry about a lot of other things.
Yeah, you don't have like all this API hanging around that you have to mock or anything like that. It's just your thing.
Yeah. And actually, to that end, there is a test driver that, because you want to individually unit test all your bits or your individual parts, but it is nice to run an end-to-end test to make sure everybody's playing nicely together. And there is a test driving framework that's nice because you can write you can give it the inputs and specify it and then test the expected output. But it doesn't require Kafka. It's all done kind of in memory, which is nice because then that makes the test very fast to run.
What's that called? What would somebody Google if they wanted to get to docs on that?
Or is it last name? Processor test driver, I believe. I could look that up. I have to.
Yeah. Like any programmer, what you do is you Google things. You don't remember things.
I'm right there with you.
I've lost the ability to remember things.
Yeah.
So we'll make sure to put that in the show notes because that's a super handy, potentially super handy thing because when you're writing Kafka Streams apps, you're being a Java programmer. And when you're being a Java programmer, you have hopefully little excuse for not writing tests because, these frameworks are pretty rich and mature at this point. And one of the things I love about Streams, like I said, is that I don't feel like it's getting in my way. If I want to test first, or if I just want to have test coverage, despite it being this, if you think of it, it's operational life and it's got thread pools and, there's a producer and a consumer under the covers and there's all this infrastructure stuff happening. As an API, it feels like it's trying to help me test my code, which is always a nice thing.
Yeah. No, it's really nice. It kind of gets you out of, like I said before, it gets you out of the low-level details. And what I really like about Kafka Streams versus other frameworks is, A, you don't need a processing cluster. You can spin this up and just run it on your laptop. And it's all the Kafka protocol, if you will. There's a couple of points. Let me see if I can make sense of this here. So you're ingesting your data into Kafka. Let's just say that you're the nervous center, the nervous system of your operation. That's bringing your event-driven data in.
Sure. I got messages in a topic.
Yeah. And you want to do some work on those. I can't begin to tell you how powerful it is to open up your laptop, write a simple program. Okay, you're not going to be running this against production. No one does that. But let's just say you have replicated environments and you've got a dev Kafka cluster that's bringing in data. To open up your laptop and quickly write a program that's going to hit that and you can see the results and just run a simple program right there in your laptop that is going to be the real thing, you know, you see right then and there what it is. And that's just so powerful, because versus writing the code, maybe there's a local framework you can run to stub it out, but then to have to ship it out and deploy it and make sure, you know, to deploy it to this other framework and then go in and run it, it's several extra steps. Where this is just, like I said, I use IntelliJ. So you fire up IntelliJ.
You run the code. You run the code literally in IntelliJ.
Yeah, and that's it. You have your, and it's just, it could be, and it could be as simple as, you know, you're consuming from that topic. You write it, and you consume from that topic, and you could just be printing stuff to standard out, saying, "What happens if I do this? What am I even getting?"
Yeah, I just want to explore the data a little bit. You know, you can kind of scratch that out in public static void main.
Yeah,
you know, new stream builder, and there you are.
Yeah, boom, so, and you're done.
Now, I want to dig into that separate processing cluster a little bit, and let me frame that a little bit. Now, there is, it's Kafka. There's a cluster. It's, you know, there's brokers, and sometimes there's the development case where those broker, you know, there's a broker process running natively on my laptop, or maybe I have a few of them in Docker containers, or maybe I've got them in the cloud, or I got some on-prem thing and I'm on the VPN, whatever. You know, there's brokers. There's a Kafka cluster. There's always a Kafka cluster.
Yes.
So that's there. There's data infrastructure that exists. And conventionally, if you look at other APIs or other projects that have tried to solve the problem of stream processing, they usually start with the assumption that also we're going to need a cluster of computers on which to run the stream processing program. That's the normal assumption.
Yes.
And you said you don't need that with Kafka Streams. So just talk us through from a deployment kind of standpoint. By the way, this is all very counterintuitive to people just encountering Kafka Streams for the first time. I found that they usually find this mind-blowing. So talk us through that no processing cluster. How does it work, and why did the team make that decision?
Yeah. Well, the decision for having it be an application versus processing cluster, that was prior to my joining.
But so presumably there was some good reason.
Well, my assumption there is for simplicity, just because if you have an application, like I said, you spin it up on your laptop to test it out. But then once you have it, it's a jar file. And then you just deploy it, and then you just kick it off and run it. So how you deploy it really depends on how much data you have and what your needs are. It's very easy to, let's just say you want to, your processing needs are light. So you create it, you take your jar, and you start it on a separate machine, and it'll start processing, you know, doing whatever you want it to do for you.
Consuming messages and grouping and filtering and joining and whatever. Yeah,
whatever your operations are. And let's just say you want to push your final results out to Kafka, and then you want other consumers, be whether it be Elasticsearch,
dump it in MongoDB,
whatever. Yeah. And then you've got the Kafka connector framework that can then distribute to those other disparate systems. But let's just say you've got heavier processing needs. Let's say you've got a fair number of partitions. I know I'm making an assumption here that you listeners know what a partition is, but you've got a fair number of partitions, and it's too much to run on one, not too much, but you really want to parallelize it. You want to take advantage of the fact that, you know, by having multiple partitions, you can process this data in parallel, process these events in parallel. So you would take that same jar, and let's just say you've got a beefy machine that's got like 32 cores on it. You could spin off several instances of that on that one machine. And then each one has you have a unique application ID, and
each one of those instances would have that same application ID that says
each one has the same program. Application.
Same code.
Under the covers to the Kafka brokers to the group coordinator, it just lets producers and consumers. So it's going to say, okay, you spun off, say, five instances, and we'll just make it simple. We're going to say there, you can specify the number of threads you run within a Kafka Streams program application. Sure. But for now, we're just going to make it simple and say it's single-threaded, but you spin off five instances.
So each is single-threaded now, and they
exactly.
Each one has a core, and that's all cool.
Yeah. So to the group coordinator, it looks like five consumers from the same group are requesting access to this topic.
Exactly. As far as the cluster is concerned, this is a consumer group, and there are five instances in the consumer group.
Yeah. Right. And so they're going to give it partition assignments, and it's going to start processing that data, and away you go. Now, what's really nice about this, okay, so you're on, you've got your, let's just say you've got 10 partitions, and you find that you run five instances, and that does your processing needs. So that means each instance is going to get assigned two partitions. But then you find data spikes from time to time. Let's just say middle of the day, you get this for between 2 and 4 every day. This is a bit of a simplistic example. Between 2 and 4 every day, you get kind of a rush. And you'd really like to double your capacity. So what you could do is, let's just say on a separate second machine, you spin up another five instances. So it's going to automatically rebalance so that each instance now is going to get assigned one partition, and you've now just doubled your throughput because you've got a topic with 10 partitions. So now you've got 10 stream instances running. Each one's processing, you know, one partition's worth of data. And we're assuming there's a lot of that each partition's getting hit equally with an equal volume of data, and it's pretty heavy.
Right. And assume that operational simplicity here. Yeah.
Yeah. But that happens. You don't have to stop. You just spin up those new five instances, and there's a rebalance, and it's automatically taken care of. Those new five instances, they get work. The previous five instances give up half of their work. They're happy. They're each one's working on two partitions. They happily give up one of them, and everybody's processing, and they're happy. Your peak period's over, and you're like, you know, the marketing folks need to use computer, whatever. I'm being kind of silly.
I want to reduce my cloud costs, whatever.
You know? Exactly. You kill that machine. Your five instances go away. Your original five instances remain. Another rebalance happens, and they go back to picking up their extra partition worth of work. And the cool thing is, this is all dynamic. You don't incur any downtime. You can add or subtract operational instances, if you will, and it'll just dynamically grow or shrink as it needs to. And that's the key, real key thing there. So, you know, I always go back to talking about running it on your laptop. It's a jar. You deploy that application somewhere, and that's it. So it doesn't. You don't need a dedicated cluster.
Right. Right. So you just said it. So, what's interesting is I said, hey, what's this deal with you don't need a processing cluster? And you described consumer group rebalancing, which sounds like, you know, if I didn't know anything about this, it sounds like you just described a processing cluster. So kind of in other words, summarizing what you just said, Kafka Streams is designed in such a way that you don't need a separate processing cluster because the Kafka consumer group coordination mechanism already means your application is one of those things, right? Like you already get horizontal elastic scalability if you're a Kafka consumer. So it's like the whole processing cluster thing is built in. So I've got some application that, let's say my application does something other than stream processing, right? I don't know what it is. Maybe it's a Spring Boot app, or there's something that it does, exposes a web front end. I don't know. Yeah. And maybe I need to scale that out. Maybe I don't, maybe I just need to scale it out a little bit, but I've already got some way of deploying that application. I know how to do that. That's by definition. Maybe that deployment mechanism is incredibly cool. Like when I push commits, merge commits to master and CI tests pass, my Kubernetes cluster automatically upgrades with, you know, maybe it's like space age. Maybe I'm hot deploying a war file to Tomcat because I like 2004. It doesn't matter. it was a good year, you know.
At least you didn't say WebLogic, so.
Right? No. It's a family podcast. It doesn't matter how I do the deployment. I can deploy code, but that's a given. And like Streams doesn't really have an opinion about how you do that. But because you can deploy code and because consumer groups are what they are, you can scale your code. And so adding stream processing to my Spring Boot or whatever thing it is I am, whatever kind of Java application I am, certainly adds heat. You know, there's more computation happening in consuming these messages and doing whatever it is it's doing. And there's more IO, which is going to put pressure on my scaling. But look, it's okay. We already know how to scale out because we're a Kafka consumer group. So I love the architecture. And, you know, I am myself familiar with this stuff. So sometimes I forget to be impressed with the architectural elegance of the thing. But Streams takes this really hard problem of how do we build a distributed processing cluster and says, well, we kind of had that lying around with Kafka anyway. So let's just use that one. You know, I love it. So I love that answer.
Yeah. I was going to say, because Kafka itself is already a distributed system and Streams just leverages what's already built into Kafka.
Yeah.
So it just, you know, all of that's already handled for you. And you just basically, and you know, the one thing I forgot to mention that I think is powerful and you touched on it, is I was speaking solely in terms of having a Streams application by itself, an application that runs by itself. Right. But you can easily embed that in an existing application. Like you mentioned something, you have a Spring Boot application. Let's just say you're running some sort of application already and you need to you want to get real-time events into that application. It's easy to embed Kafka Streams into that application.
Single dependency. So add to your Gradle or Maven build file, and now you have the API. So
yeah, cool. Exactly.
Okay, cross examining you on that a little bit. That's a great story, but hey, isn't that assuming again a listener who knows something about Kafka, maybe even knows something about consumer groups? That whole scale story is true merely of being a Kafka consumer. So, and we know when we're writing Kafka consumers, as I said this before, I think if you're stateless, the way consumer group scale is trivial. And so if I'm a Streams app and all I'm doing is filtering or mapping values or something stateless like that, that whole scale out and scale back scenario you just described sounds kind of trivial. What if I am stateful? What if I'm grouping, for example, or running an aggregation where I have to have things in memory? Talk to us about what Streams does there.
Yeah. Well, that's the other great point about Kafka Streams. If I could take a step back and just talk about stream processing in general, there's kind of, at least for me, the first assumption is you have these discrete events that have nothing to do with each other. And you're just processing each event.
Sure.
But in the real world, that's not always true. Like if you're,
I was going to say that's a great world. Like that's a Star Trek episode, and I want to live in that.
Exactly.
World, but, right.
But usually you want to know some kind of state. You know, you're tracking stock purchase. You know, how many share. You know, or your purchases. You know, or you're looking at events. You know, this same IP is, you know, trying to hit. You know, make this strange request and it's, you know, what's going on here? So you need to keep track. You need state. You need to remember, if you will. I like to think of it as adding context or remembering what you've seen before.
Yeah. And, like, have you seen this credit card number authorized in the last 5 seconds more than 3 times or something? That's a stateful question.
Yeah, exactly. So Streams offers state kind of right out of the box. It provides state. And one of the key things about that state is it's local. Under the covers, well, there's different types of state stores. You can have an in-memory or you can have a persistent state store, which uses RocksDB under the covers. But it's local. It's local to that task. So, you know, you, like you said, you going back to the example, you get a credit card number. Have I seen this before? Or how many times have I seen this in the past hour? You go to look it up. It's local. You're not making another network trip out somewhere to do that. It's local state right there. And now again, talking about the real world, what happens when you crash? Because as much as we hate to admit it, crashes happen. Things bad things happen. Bad things happen to good computers. you have these state stores, even the in-memory state stores, are backed by a changelog topic. So basically, as you're writing to your state store, now there's some tweaks to this that I'll make, but I'll just give you the high-level view right now. As you're adding things to your state store, they're being backed up by a changelog topic. So if that instance, let's just say you're running, make it simple, you're running on one instance, you've got one machine, and you're doing counts by credit card ID, and you can also window these things, but I'll cover
that's
that
not,
also.
Yeah, that's windowing gets its own podcast.
Yeah. So you're doing grouping and you're doing these aggregations and your computer dies. You're able to bring it back up, but everything on that disk is just gone. So you think, okay, what just happened to my state?
Right.
Well, when you start it back up, that state, your process is going to start back up. That state store was backed by a changelog topic. It's going to read that changelog topic and get back to the point it was of the last commit, because the changelog topic is just a topic. And so it commits as it's making, as you're saving the state of the store, if you will, you've got commits. It's going to replay, it's going to refill that store up to the last committed offset. So it's fault tolerant. All your state stores, even your in-memory state stores, are fault tolerant in that respect.
So if my last message that I had consumed, because again, the streaming application is consuming and producing. That's all you can do as a Kafka client. You know, we're adding all kinds of fancy abstractions on top of that. But as far as Kafka knows, there's this consumer and it's consuming from some input topic of, say, you know, credit card authorization attempts, and it's grouping them by card number, which means in memory, one way or another, there's like a hash table. And the key is card number, and the value is, I don't know, whatever, count or something. Yeah. So there's this in-memory hash table. But as I'm consuming messages from my authorizations topic, I'm going to consume from some offset. Like the last one I read was offset 1,048,576. And I'll commit that offset to the cluster saying, I have officially consumed 1,048,576. Also, you're saying, it sounds like, if I may, atomically and at the same time, more or less, the version of the state, that hash table of credit card numbers and counts in memory, I am effectively persisting that into a Kafka topic along with that offset.
Yeah. When you commit, you're committing, basically, make it simple, that record has traversed your entire topology and you're committing, saying, okay, I've read this record. It's gone through all the processors. And if one of those processors was stateful, whatever state that was that you added, that's going to be sent to a Kafka topic. And that's, that's persisted to a Kafka topic. And then when you start back up, you've got a separate consumer under the covers that reads from that and restores up to the last commit, up to the last known offset of what was in there, what was in the store.
And that restoring process, that again is when a new streaming application instance is coming up, or a new partition has been assigned or whatever, you know, I have new stuff, whether I just came to life or I just got a new partition assigned to me, I need to swap that state back in. And that separate consumer that's pulling in from that internal topic of my persisted state has to do that swapping in before I start processing new messages. And I've really come online, right?
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah. And there's another thing there's something else along with that, because what that implies is if you've got two instances, instance B dies, instance A is going to take over. And let's say instance B had a stateful operation. Well, when it comes up, it's going to have to refill the state store that instance B had. Instance A is going to have to replay that. But what can save you failover time is something, the notion of a standby task, which is a configured, it's a configuration item. Let's just say you configured your Streams application to have one standby replica. So instance B dies. Well, instance A has kept a standby replica of that state store that's on instance B. So instance B dies, A fails over, it takes over the task from B, but the state store is already populated in the state that B was when it crashed. Got so it. The failover time is much less.
Right. So if you need
a rebalance time.
Yeah. So if you need rebalance time to be very small and you've got say latency guarantees, even in the presence of failure, you need your 99th percentile to be a certain thing, then you simply invest in the compute resources to have enough standby instances that somebody is standing by all the time, and you don't have to be doing this lengthy rehydrate process. Sometimes people ask me how long that takes, and as if there's a closed form answer to that, right? Well,
so many you can't, it depends solely on how much state's there. I know it's kind of an obvious answer. There is checkpointing going on. So like if you're restarting an application, it's not going to reload the entire changelog topic each time.
Right.
That happens in the case of, a complete failure where like the disk is wiped out or something like that. That's so when it comes back online, then it's going to have to fully restore. Again, if you're using standbys and an instance dies, then it does not have to fully restore. And the trade-off with the standby is you're trading rebalance time for disk space as well.
Totally.
Because
which kind of gets into a operational topic and a thing that requires tuning.
Yeah.
Now, final thing I want to talk about. This is another thing that when I talk to people about streams, two things trip up developers. One is, what do you mean there's no processing cluster? And I love Kafka Streams' answer to that a lot. So that's easy and fun for me to explain because I like really believe that it's the right thing. And I didn't even give my entire rant on why that's such a great idea. And I'm gonna withhold that. Maybe there'll be another episode where I can just go off on that. But I really love our approach of being an API and using consumer groups to scale. But the other thing, that's counterintuitive for people, but it's awesome. The other thing that is not counterintuitive, but just hard to get, is K-tables, right? K-streams, like you said, K-stream before, and you didn't even say what one was. You started talking about K-stream and methods, and it made total sense, right? Everybody's like, yeah, I get it. There's topics and there's messages. And it's just like, obviously that's just class that abstracts over that. And now I got this functional API and I can filter and I can group and you kind of see it in your head. And you didn't say K-table, but now you say K-table, people are like, wait, okay, I don't get it. So give us the 5-minute version of K-tables.
Sure. Okay. So let's real quick. K-stream is an event stream. It's an unbounded event stream, but each event has nothing to do with the other one. They're just independent, happy events moving along. K-table is considered more, it's an update stream where, going back to the example with credit card numbers, let's say your credit card number is your key. In an event stream, if you got 5 events with the same credit card number as the key, you don't really care. They're treated independently. But a K-table, it's considered an update. So now, you get record A, your credit card number is your key. You get the first one. Let's say the value is A. You get another one that comes in and the value is B. Well, now that second one that comes in is going to replace the first one because it's considered an update. It's not, They're not independent events anymore. For keys that aren't related to each other, they're independent, but they're no longer a K-table. It's kind of, it's an update stream.
Yeah, and it's kind of like the topic is a change log describing changes that happen to keys and not
exactly
not events in the sense of like sensor readings or credit card authorizations, but updates to a collection of keys.
Yeah. And what really kind of something under the covers that drives that, that's really neat, is the concept of a compacted topic. Because in Kafka, you have topics. And obviously, you know, you get events in, you append them to the end of the log.
Yep.
Logs need to keep growing. So eventually, at some point, you have to age off that data and you just delete the oldest data. There's different strategies you can configure, so we won't get into that here. But essentially, you're deleting older records is the bottom line. You know, so you keep appending, deleting the old stuff. K-table uses a compacted topic, which is unique in the fact that you're not deleting data, you're keeping the latest record for a given key. So it goes through. So if I got my Tim record yesterday, and let's just say I have an aggressive, you know, I want to keep that topic small. And let's just say stuff is removed every few hours, but I got my Tim record yesterday. But that was the last record I got for Tim. It would still be there today because a compacted topic goes through and keeps the latest record for a given key.
Right.
So it trims it that way, but you always have, like you said, it's a change log. It's a change log now. It's no longer just this log of discrete events.
Everything. And you only really care about the most recent one if you're trying to make it into a table. Whatever values of the Tim key existed before, you're explicitly saying you don't care about the history. You just want to know the current state. And that's the way of doing that with keeping storage of this kind of data efficient is this topic log compaction thing.
And one thing that's interesting about a K-table is it kind of, I don't know, puts the database on its head, or flips the idea of a database around, because you're treating your stream as a table now, a table. Yes, it's streaming and it's constantly flowing through, but at any point in time, you could kind of think of it as a table.
Exactly.
Because constantly being updated.
You can turn streams into tables. I mean, in the API, there are ways of taking a K stream. Well, I guess most obviously grouping, right?
Group,
and then apply any kind of aggregation to the group. The object that is going to be returned by that method is going to be a K table. You turn a stream into a table. And of course, if you've got this compacted changelog topic out there lying around in your Kafka cluster, you can also say, hey, I would like to have a K table object backed by that thing. Turn this raw changelog topic data into this beautiful API object now that lets you do all kinds of cool things. Like, you know, you can join a stream to it or join it to another table or do whatever it is you need to do.
Yeah. Now there's one other thing. Can I tell you one other thing I really love about Kafka streams? Do we have time?
Yeah, we do.
I'll make this quick.
Totally. I would love that.
Interactive queries, because I've mentioned state stores before. I won't go too deep into the weeds here, but Kafka Streams creates tasks. Depending on the layout of your source topic, it could be a task per partition. And we'll assume that.
Good. I always tell people that's what it is, so I'm glad that's not untrue. Apparently that's a simplification.
Yeah. No, that could be. I mean, you know, there's other scenarios where you might not have a task per partition. Okay. But when you're explaining it, it's much easier to say, I've got one topic with five partitions. You're going to end up with five tasks.
Nobody's ever gotten mad about that, right?
Okay. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Now let's make it six tasks, because what we're going to do is we're going to say, I want to run this in two separate applications for some fault tolerance, whether it's on the same box or a different box, whatever. And it's stateful. but you want to see what's going on. You want to view into that state, but you've got two application instances. So how do you, you know, so you're going to have top, you're going to have partitions 0, 1, 2 on one instance and 2, 3, 4, 5 on the other.
So in other words, I have a K table and I want to get the value of some arbitrary key, which may or may not be in my task, right?
Yeah, you don't know where it is. You don't know where it is. So what interactive queries does is it exposes, it kind of, it's an abstraction over the state store notion that it allows you to, when those two instances go up, they'll, you have to specify the, I forget the exact config name, we'll put that in the show notes, but they will know about each other. And then you can do interactive queries where you can just query all of the state stores that are running under the covers in your streams applications. But to you, you don't know that. You just issue a query. And let's just say you say, hey, I've got this credit card number. I want to see the count or all the purchase, whatever you've done, your stateful operation you've done by this credit card number. Interactive queries allows you to see that regardless, and it, you will find it wherever it is, whatever state store it's in, it'll find it and you can get those results.
Whether it's in
so the essentially
assigned to your task or not.
Exactly. So it allows you to set up, you can query that and see the state of your state, so to speak, as it's happening. Because typically what would happen in the past, at least in my experience, pre-Kafka Streams, you get data, you have to publish it out. Whatever you're doing, you get some data, you do some processing on it. And if people want to see those results each time you process, you'd have to publish it out to a separate database table.
Exactly.
And then there'd be a web application that would hit that database table. Well, now you don't need that database table. You just do an interactive query and see what's in your state stores. And it's if the key you're asking for, like you just have to hit one application instance. And if that application instance doesn't have it, it'll query the other application instances for you on your behalf and find where it is. Exactly.
You have effectively in the form of a K table, you do have a little distributed database under the covers there. And so that it doesn't, I'm careful the way I talk about this architecturally. This does not make all relational databases go away. It's not like you're never going to ever deploy one again, but, you're going to probably deploy fewer of them and like the need for a big giant database. I mean, it kind of starts to get pulled into your Java application a little bit. Like you said, you've turned the database inside out. Now the fundamental piece of infrastructure is, this big giant log. And you're just making little tables and little materialized views of that log in your services through Kafka Streams.
Exactly.
Well, my guest today has been Bill Bejic. Bill, thanks for being a part of Streaming Audio.
Thank you for having me on. It was a lot of fun.
You got it. And there you have it. I hope that was helpful to you. If you've got questions, you can ask me at TLBerglund on Twitter. That's TLBERGLUND. Or you can leave a comment on any of our YouTube videos. Your question might be featured on the next episode of Streaming Audio. And feel free to subscribe to our YouTube channel and this podcast wherever fine podcasts are sold. And if you subscribe through iTunes, be sure to leave us a review there. That helps other people discover the podcast and just generally helps us get the word out. We appreciate your support. See you next time.